Happy Friday, everyone. Thank you, all of you who are supporting Into the Word financially to keep us on this radio station. Anyone that likes to help in that sort of thing, just write down the contact information you'll hear at the end of today's program. Then you can send your one-time or ongoing gift of any amount to that address, and it'll be applied to those same fees. I also want to remind you, you should be in church this Lord's Day coming. Everybody should have a home church. Everybody should be very active in that home church. And we need to have a place where we encourage one another to love and good deeds. And we pray together and praise together and serve together. All the things that are part of a church family. So if you don't have a place like that, you need to go out and find one. And you need to get plugged in and stay plugged in there. And as I always say, if you happen to be looking right now and you're within driving distance of the Elkhart East building, please come check us out. Maybe we'll be the place you'll settle down and call home. We are going to go to Exodus chapter number 15 and start with verse number 11. This is a psalm. It is a song. You should imagine it being sung to music, and there's dancing that's going on as well. But you should understand that it is also a prophecy. It's not a future prophecy. It's not that type of foretelling. It is a supernatural expression of what God wants us to know. And so Miriam is a prophetess, just like Moses and Aaron are prophets. And she is involved in the composition of this song. And there is a lot of talking, a lot of singing of what God has done and what should be learned from what God has done in the crossing of the Red Sea. Now, Hebrew poetry often takes the form of giving a phrase and then giving a second phrase that pretty much says the same thing, just different words. And so you'll see some of that here in this song. You will also see just retelling of historical stories in dramatic form. And so that's definitely part of this song. So we've already done part of it. Let's go ahead and pick up in verse 11, where it says, "Who is like you, O he who is among the gods?" So that's the God wannabes, the fallen angels, the fake and fraud spiritual beings that have tried to convince people of planet Earth that they are gods and goddesses. None of them are like God, the real God. "Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders." So all the things that God has done, the psalmists are saying, no one can do anything like that. "You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them." So that's a reference to the Egyptians that died when the walls of the crossing point, the water walls of the crossing point, were collapsed down on top of them. Verse 13, "You have led your steadfast love, the people whom you have redeemed." Now, steadfast love, this is a Hebrew word I've been trying to teach all of you, chesed. If you want to write it out, it's H-E-S-E-D is probably the closest thing you're going to get. It is to represent the fact that God likes us and he wants what's best for us. It is an emotional word. So you have led in your steadfast love, your chesed, the people whom you've redeemed. So God loved the Israeli people, liked them, redeemed them, and brought them through the Red Sea to protect them. "You have guided them by your strength to your holy abode." So they are on their way to meet God at Mount Sinai. And so that becomes part of the song here. "The people have heard. They tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. So as I was mentioning, there were witnesses to this event from the Egyptian side, Pharaoh among them. Thutmose III does not die by drowning in the sea here. He goes on to basically break the power base of Canaan. So the Egyptian witnesses of this event, they talk about it. And people passing through or having business in Egypt hear this, and it gets passed all over the lower Middle East. And when they hear this stuff, it scares them. Because what kind of God can do this sort of stuff? Not just the crossing of the sea. Remember, that's the climax of the 10 plagues. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. So that's the coastline of Canaan. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. That's to the south and east of Canaan. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. So that's the east side of the Jordan Valley. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. They are scared. And some of these words, some of this phrase in this psalm gets picked up by Rahab when she describes why she was willing to hide the spies and confess her trust in the God of the Hebrews. Terror and dread fall upon them because of the greatness of your arm. They are as still as a stone, so they are frozen in fear. Till your people, O he who is, pass by, till the peoples pass by whom you have purchased. So because God has been doing these supernatural events on behalf of Israel, it scares a lot of the people when they see Israel coming by. Now, not all of them. We'll discover later that there was one particular group that very foolishly attacked Israel regardless of these stories. Verse number 17. You will bring them in, that is, into the promised land, and plant them on your own mountain. The place, O he who is, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O he who is, which your hands have established. So in this psalm, the prophets who were involved in the writing of this psalm, Moses and Miriam and Aaron perhaps, they know that the promised land is going to become the center of the life of the Israelis and their relationship with God. So that gets put into the psalm. Verse 18 finishes it out. He who is will reign forever and ever. Because, of course, God is king. Verse 19. For when the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, he who is brought back the waters of the sea upon them. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground in the midst of the sea. Now, that's the second time we were reminded that the reason this psalm is written down is because of the events of the crossing of the Red Sea. The fact that the Israelis had no problem, but the Egyptians did. Then Miriam, the prophetess. Now, my guess is she's about 6 years older, at least, than Moses. Aaron is about 3 years older than Moses. So she is specified here as a prophetess, meaning the Holy Spirit speaks through her. And apparently she expresses it in song form here. Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a tambourine in her hand. Now, when I think of a tambourine, I think of a little wooden ring that's got little metal chinglings, you know, in the edges of it. And that's not what you should think of here. The word in Hebrew is a tof, And that's an onomatopoeia. It's supposed to represent the sound of when you hit this. It's a hand drum. Toof, 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 toof. It's a percussion instrument to keep rhythm. And so she took a tambourine or a toof in her hand, a hand drum, and all the women went out after her with hand drums, and they were dancing. So this becomes a cultural celebration. It becomes a celebration of the entire community. And so a whole bunch of the ladies among this huge group, they grab up their little hand drums and they go on a little line dance, apparently, through the areas of the encampment. And they're singing as they go. Miriam sang to them, "Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea." And so this is the celebration that wraps up the crossing of the Red Sea. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that Miriam is the one that actually wrote the part that's in verse number 21 here, which is the first part of the song that we read earlier in this chapter. I think that other, the longer part of it, the stretched out part of that psalm, may have been written as the Exodus goes on. So what we have is the morning after the crossing, before everybody goes to bed, we have this celebration that Miriam seems to be leading in. The ladies of the community seem to be leading in. And my suggestion I've made to you, I'm going to make it one more time. I believe that this event, the crossing of the Red Sea, probably happened on the 21st, which is the last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And this is my reason for thinking it now. They were not allowed to allow their bread to rise while they were moving quickly. Once it was no longer necessary for them to move quickly, they could let their bread rise. My expectation is that once the Egyptian mobile force was annihilated, and Pharaoh tucked his tail between his legs metaphorically and went back to Egypt and gave up, they didn't need to move fast anymore. They could be more leisurely in their walking and traveling. And therefore, they could raise their bread at their encampments. And so I think the first 7 days of the Exodus go between the 15th when they left and the 21st when they crossed the Red Sea. That's my thesis for you. Now, the next part of the story is traveling again. It says that Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. Now, the wilderness of Shur is in it's in the Sinai Peninsula, and it's the eastern side of the Delta region. So that whole area there, it could be that Shur represents outposts and might actually represent kind of the guarded borderline of Egypt proper. So they went 3 days in the wilderness and they found no water. So 3 days travel eastward from the Red Sea and no water. It's very dry. And that's a problem because if I'm correct, that means that they are now about 10 days on their journey from Egypt. And their water supplies have all probably dried up by now. But they did find water on this next day. It says, when they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter, and therefore they named it Marah. So they found some water, but it was undrinkable. The people grumbled against Moses. Well, what are we supposed to drink? So this, again, reminds us that there is rebelliousness just bubbling under the surface all the time with this generation of Israelites that have come out of Egypt. They get angry with Moses for almost anything. And so Moses cried to the Lord, meaning he prayed, and he who has showed him a log, possibly a tree that was already standing up, and so he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. So this bitter water gets turned into sweet water, drinkable water, because of the supernatural intervention of God. It wasn't a natural thing. You don't purify water by tossing a twig in it. The tossing of the wood into the water was just to give a point of contact, a point of observation for the people, to see that something is being changed by God. Kind of like the whole staff thing. Moses could have just spoke and the waters opened up at God's command, but God has given him a stick that he can raise up, and people are focused on that stick as being the way that God is doing stuff. All right. There he who is made for them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them, saying, if you will diligently listen to the voice of he who is your God and do that which is right in his eyes and give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians, for I am he who is your healer, Rapha. Yeah, I think is the Hebrew here. So God says, all right, everybody, listen up. I'm trying to teach you a lesson here, that whatever I tell you to do, just trust me. Just do it. If I tell you to throw a stick in the water to make it drinkable, then just do it and trust me. Because if you'll just trust me, then you won't end up in the same boat that the Egyptians ended up in. Because they did not trust God. They did not believe and act in faith toward God. And they ended up with all those plagues. And so God is appealing to this generation, which we'll find out later, they're very bad. I mean, they're actually carrying secret idols with them in their tents. God is trying to appeal to them to change their hearts. Then, verse 27, we have another change of location. They came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. Now, you might remember that I told you Numbers chapter 33 has a detailed list of all the stopping places during the Exodus experience. Numbers 33, verse number 8, which is kind of where we left the last time we were here, it says that they set out from Hahirot and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness, and then they went a 3 days' journey in the wilderness of Etam and camped at Marah, and then they set out from Marah and they came to Elim, and at Elim there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm branches, or palm trees, and they camped there. And then the next thing it says there is they set out from Elim and camped at the Red Sea. Now, this Red Sea is the Gulf of Aqaba arm. And that tells us that they're basically marching across the Sinai Peninsula between the northern tip of the Suez Arm of the Red Sea to the northern tip of the Aqaba Arm of the Red Sea, because Midian is to the east of the northern tip of the Aqaba Arm of the Red Sea. And that is where Mount Sinai is going to be. And that is where they're heading toward. So my whole point in all of that is that they are moving across the Sinai Peninsula between these two branches of the Red Sea. They're not going deep down south into the Gulf, or into the Sinai Peninsula, because that St. Catherine's Monastery site is just not authentic. And that I would advise you not to fall into that belief system. Even though it goes a long ways back, it's just not accurate. All right, back to our Exodus passage, Exodus 16. So they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, or Sinai as we often say it, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. All right, so this tells us that in the 1 month of travel from Egypt, the land of Goshen, down past the northern end of the Gulf of Sinai, or Gulf of Suez, and across that the middle portion of the Sinai Peninsula, heading over toward the Gulf of Aqaba part of the Red Sea, they've taken about a month to do that. They've averaged probably each day that they traveled 20 to 30 miles. Maybe now that they're not being pursued by the forces, they might have slowed it down to, you know, 10 to 20 miles a day. But they are getting closer and closer to Mount Sinai, where they're going to meet God. But in that month of travel, they've run out of supplies. They've eaten up all of the food products that they brought with them out of Egypt. And they're starting to get grumbly about that. Verse number 3. The whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The people of Israel said to them, "Oh, would that we had died by the hand of he who is in the land of Egypt." Now, think about that. That line means we would have been better off to die like all those Egyptians died under the plagues. "Oh, would that we had died by the hand of he who is in the land of Egypt, where we sat by the meat pots and ate bread in full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Now, understand, they were slaves. For the most part, these people were workaday people, 7 days a week, 15 hours a day or more. They probably got slave rations. They had meat for protein. They had bread also for the carbohydrates. We'll learn later that they all were allowed to kind of grow their own vegetables and catch their own fish. But now they've used up all their supplies. They look back on that as being the good old days when they were in slavery and had food each day. And so, "You brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So they accuse Moses of having sinful intentions toward them in bringing them out here. Then he who is said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day." So this is going to be the introduction of the bread from heaven, also known as manna, and we'll discover why that name gets attached to it. But I want you to pay attention to the reason why God let them get hungry before he provided this supernatural food for them. It says in the rest of that verse, "that I might test them whether they will walk in my law or not." So God lets them get hungry, and this actually comes from Deuteronomy chapter 8, where God specifically says he did this. He brought them into the middle of the place where there was no food, was no water. Let them be hungry, let them be thirsty, because he wanted to see whether or not they would trust him, do what he told them to do. And so here come some of the instructions. "On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So from the very beginning, God tells Moses, they will have 6 days where they will have a ration's worth of food material provided. But on that sixth day, they will get a double ration. And this was to help them enjoy the Sabbath day, where they didn't have to cook, because they did all the food cooking, all the food prep on the day before the Sabbath. And so we will detail all of that when we get back together again the next time we're into the Word.